Well, I invite you to turn with me to our sermon text in 2 Samuel. We're working our way through 1 and 2 Samuel. We've been doing so for over a year at this point, and now we're in 2 Samuel chapter 16. And we're at a point in the books of Samuel where David has committed his grievous sin with Bathsheba, and then all the sins connected to that, his arranging of the murder of Bathsheba's husband, and then the terrible things that took place in David's family among his own children in the aftermath of that. Just last week, though, we started to see something good about David again, but it came in the midst of another sore trial in David's life as his son leads a coup, his son Absalom. And so David is on the run once again at this point here in chapter 16. He has left Jerusalem because Absalom has won the hearts of the people and has too much power. David was not going to subject the citizens of Jerusalem to a siege, and so he went into exile. And we look at this passage tonight, we'll see how David's faith is continuing to be fanned into flame in the midst of this trial. It's, I think, a really encouraging thing when we think about it that way. So let's listen now to God's holy and inspired word, 2 Samuel 16 in its entirety. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord, the king." When King David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood." Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head." But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he's cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David,' who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? Leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today." So David and his men went on the road, while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And when Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" And Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you." Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give your counsel. What shall we do?" Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went in to his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and by Absalom. And thus far the reading of God's holy and inspired word. And all God's people said, Amen. So David's son Absalom has stolen the hearts of the people, and he has declared himself to be king over Israel. And as I just noted, David wanted to spare the people of Jerusalem from the horrors of a siege. And so he led his household, he led his servants out of the city, and he entrusted himself into the hands of the Lord in the midst of this crisis. So once again, David finds himself on the run. And we saw last week that the Lord provided David with some much needed encouragement in the midst of this sore trial. Back in chapter 15, we saw, first of all, that there was the fierce loyalty of a foreigner, of this Philistine mercenary named Ittai. And he said to David, when David told him, "You don't have to follow me. You didn't sign up for this. Go back to Jerusalem and just serve Absalom until all this gets sorted out." Ittai said, "No, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be." Well, how refreshing that would have been to David to see that loyalty from an unexpected source there. And then there was also the opportunity that he had near the end of the passage in chapter 15 to send his friend and his trusted advisor, Hushai the Archite, back to Jerusalem in hopes of sabotaging the shrewd counsel of Ahithophel. David was very concerned that Ahithophel was on Absalom's side in this coup, because Ahithophel was a very shrewd counselor, as we're reminded at the end of the chapter here that we've just read. His word was almost like the word of God. People took it that seriously, both David and Absalom. So the Lord encouraged David, and yet the Lord also ordained more trials for David. And we see that here in chapter 16. We see him being deceived. We see him being cursed. And we see him being betrayed. So those are the three points we're going to be looking at as we work our way through this text. David had been forgiven of his sin with Bathsheba. He had been counted righteous on the basis of his faith in God's promise. And yet the Lord let these trials come upon him in order to chasten him and in order to refine his faith. So the chapter begins with this man named Ziba coming out to meet David as David had left the city of Jerusalem. Ziba, we were told earlier in 2 Samuel, was the servant of Saul's crippled grandson Mephibosheth, which is a really fun name to say multiple times again and again, if you want a tongue twister. But Mephibosheth, the Lord had restored all that belonged to Saul to Mephibosheth. And he had done that in order to keep his promise that he had made to both Saul and Jonathan back in 1 Samuel. So prior to that restoration, who had all of Saul's holdings? Ziba did. He was the steward. He had all that property, and Saul had a lot of property. You know, he was the king. And so here, what we're seeing happening in the first part of chapter 16 is Ziba is seizing the opportunity that's provided by Absalom's usurpation of the throne. And he has devised a ploy in order to get that property back. And it works, as we see. So Ziba's strategy is to bring refreshment to the king and to all who are with him. He brings out a pair of donkeys. He brings some food and wine for David and for those who are with him. And these supplies were much needed, and they would have been greatly appreciated by David. And we can certainly say that this was the Lord's provision for David in the midst of this trial. Here's more encouragement and help from the Lord. Ziba certainly had ulterior motives, and yet the Lord worked through this to help David. At the same time, though, this strategy caused David to look favorably on Ziba and to take him at his word, which is exactly what Ziba wanted. When David asked where Mephibosheth was, then Ziba seized the opportunity. He told the king, well, Mephibosheth, he decided to stay in Jerusalem. And you know why? Because he thinks that now the throne is going to come back to him. It's going to come back to the house of Saul, now that there's this turbulence and instability. Well, Mephibosheth tells a very different story in just a few chapters. In chapter 19, David confronts him about this and says, "What? Why didn't you come after me? Why did you stay in Jerusalem?" And Mephibosheth tells a very different story, that it was not at all the case that he was betraying David. And so it's, you know, a situation where you have one man's word against another man's word. Who was telling the truth here? Well, I think that several factors indicate that Mephibosheth was the one who was telling the truth, that he was loyal to David, and that Ziba was lying and was being an opportunist here. First of all, it wouldn't have made sense for Mephibosheth to think along the lines that Ziba says he was thinking here. Now, think about what has happened. Absalom was from the house of David, right? He is the son of David. At this point, he is David's oldest son, the heir to the throne. Why in the world would Mephibosheth think that if the son of David takes the throne, even if he is seizing it as a usurper, why would Mephibosheth think that now all of a sudden there was a path to the throne for him as a member of the house of Saul? That simply doesn't make any sense. The Davidic dynasty had not been broken in any sense. Furthermore, it would have been unreasonable to expect a crippled man like Mephibosheth to go on the run with David. David himself said in the previous chapter that his friend Hushai shouldn't come with him. He should go back to Jerusalem. Hushai was in full health, but he wasn't a soldier. He wasn't used to this kind of life. And David said, "You're going to be a burden to me. Just go back to Jerusalem." And so if Hushai being with David would have been a burden, how much more would that have been the case with Mephibosheth? So I think those two factors indicate that Ziba is lying here. And yet David takes Ziba at his word. And David, maybe in the heat of his anger, as he's thinking about Mephibosheth's betrayal, he declares that all of Mephibosheth's property is now in Ziba's hands. And this was a very rash decision for David to make, and David would later regret it. He should not have made this ruling without hearing Mephibosheth's side of things, or at least in some way looking into the veracity of what Ziba was telling him. And yet David was in trying circumstances, and he let himself be manipulated and deceived by an opportunist. And Matthew Henry has some good words here. He says this serves as a warning that great men, and I think we could also apply this to all of our lives, but he says great men ought always to be jealous of flatterers. And by jealous, I think he means they're suspicious of flatterers. And remember that nature has given them two ears that they may hear both sides. I think that's a good assessment of what's going on here. So that brings us to the second part of the passage, the second trial that comes upon David here. Here David travels through a city in the territory of the tribe of Benjamin, a city named Bahurim. And Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And as we see here, he still had supporters among the members of his tribe. And one of these supporters is this man named Shimei. And David, as he's coming through Bahurim, Shimei curses him. And he even throws stones in his direction. Later on, he picks up dirt and throws it towards David, at least in his direction. Kind of reminds me of, I don't know if you ever have seen video footage of Earl Weaver, the Baltimore Orioles baseball manager. He was famous for his tirades against umpires, and sometimes he would pick up dirt and throw it at the umpire and get thrown out of the game to motivate his team to win. Shimei is doing that sort of thing. I've never been treated that way, but I can't imagine what that would be like. I can imagine how tempting it would be to take Abishai up on his offer here, right? You know. So Shimei, basically he is reading God's hand of providence here. He's saying, look at what has happened to you, David. Your son, Absalom, has led this coup. And what does that say? It proves that you're a man of blood. It proves that you unjustly supplanted Saul as Israel's king. Now, anyone who has read 1 and 2 Samuel knows that there is no basis to this charge. Absolutely no basis. David was not a man of blood, at least in this respect. On multiple occasions, David had an opportunity to take Saul's life. Remember those occasions in the cave? The one time at the camp? David refused to seize those opportunities, even though Saul was trying to kill him. And so David is innocent, at least of this particular sin. And so we can say that Absalom's rebellion was not a punishment against David for overthrowing Saul. And so Shimei is actually misinterpreting God's hand of providence here. Now, we certainly, I think, can say, in light of the larger context here, that this rebellion was part of God's discipline in David's life. God was chastening David here for his sin with Bathsheba. But I think that one thing that this shows us is we shouldn't be surprised if the world tries to do this sort of thing, if the enemies of the church try to do this sort of thing. In looking at the trials that God's people go through and saying, look, you're just getting what you deserved. And they misinterpret providence in the same sort of way. So Abishai hears Shimei cursing David in this way, and he suggests a solution. He's a man of action. He tells the king, you know, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. That would have been very effective, wouldn't it? That certainly would have put an end to the cursing, and it would have put an end to the throwing of rocks. You're not going to be able to do any of those things without a head. But as the text tells us, Abishai was the brother of Joab. And David had learned that while these men were great military assets, their plans had a tendency to be purely pragmatic. And David wisely is suspicious of their counsel and doesn't just go with it. So instead of taking Abishai up on his offer, David tells him, stay your hand. I am going to bear this man's reproaches quietly. And so instead of seeking vengeance, David tells Abishai this. He says, leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. There are two parts to that statement, and they're both really worth reflecting on and pondering. This is an incredible statement from David here. First of all, David acknowledges God's providence over this situation. He says that God told Shimei to do this. God told him to curse him in this way. Why would David say that? Why would he interpret God's providence in this sort of way? Well, I think it's because he's examining his own heart and his own life at this point. God is chastening him and it's working. David remembered the evil things that he had done in the case of Bathsheba and Uriah. He pondered his failure to deal justly with the matters that unfolded with Amnon and Tamar and Absalom. It's true that he was innocent of the evil that this man accuses him of doing, but David knew that he was not ultimately innocent. David knew that he had done plenty of things to merit this kind of abuse. And this is something I think that we need to consider whenever people unjustly criticize us or unjustly accuse us. And we all know what that feels like. And it's very easy to go the route of Abishai, isn't it? To just say, you know what? I'm just going to take off their head. You know, not literally, I hope, but it's tempting to go that route. But we need to stay our hand, and we need to remind ourselves that yes, it may be what they're saying is completely unjustified. Perhaps maybe there's a little bit of truth in what they're saying, but maybe it's mostly unjustified. And yet, even if that's the case, we still need to remember that we're not innocent. We're not guiltless. We're not without sin. And that being the case, we should always be humbled when we find ourselves the object of somebody else's attack and entrust ourselves into the hands of the Lord, as David does here. So that's the first part. David acknowledging God's providence over the situation and being humbled here. The second thing is that David holds out hope that the Lord will somehow turn this evil into good. God will somehow turn this cursing into something that is for his own good. Now, David doesn't articulate that as clearly as Paul does, say in Romans 8:28. But it does seem that David has a basic understanding of the fact that for those who love God, all things work together for the good. I think that that's what David is getting at here, is that somehow God is going to turn this to my good. And guess what? We're seeing God do that right here, aren't we? God used this to humble David and to remind him of his own guilt and to put himself in God's hands in the midst of this. So this brings us to the last part of the passage where the scene shifts from David on the run to Absalom in Jerusalem. And it's quite a contrast in that sense. David is on the run. He's in exile. Absalom is in the palace now. He is now the king. But there's also some similarities because as David was deceived earlier in the passage, Absalom is going to be deceived here in this part of the passage and betrayed. And then David also is betrayed in this section. But amid all the fanfare that Absalom was receiving in his usurped office as king, Hushai the Archite comes up to him and he declares, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" Now that's not just a formality. That really means something. What it means is that Hushai was acclaiming Absalom as Israel's king. And he was also pledging his allegiance to Absalom as Israel's king. Now, Absalom knew that Hushai was a close and trusted friend of his father David. And so he's naturally suspicious of this acclamation. And he doesn't just accept it right off the bat. He's not so easily convinced that Hushai would shift his loyalties so quickly. And yet Hushai defends himself by saying that he will be on the side of the one whom the Lord and the people of Israel have chosen as king. And it's really interesting to just look at specifically what it is that Hushai says, because there's a sense in which you could say he's not really lying here. He's not really lying here. Who is the one whom the Lord has chosen and whom the people of Israel have chosen as their king? Rightly so, at least. Who is the true king of Israel? In Hushai's mind, it's David. It's David. And it's true that he does say, "I will serve you, Absalom, just as I have served your father." But how did he serve his father, David? Well, he served his father, David, as one whose supreme loyalty is to the Lord and to his anointed. And that's how he's going to serve Absalom. He's going to serve Absalom as one whose supreme loyalty is to the Lord and to his true anointed one and chosen one, David. In other words, he's going to betray Absalom. So I think it's kind of interesting to just look at the way Hushai expresses himself there. Now, we don't know why, but Absalom accepts Hushai's answer. Again, we see a parallel here with David. Both of them seem to be letting themselves be led astray here. But in doing this, Absalom unwittingly advanced David's plan of using Hushai to overturn the counsel of Ahithophel. And we'll see that in the next chapter next week. So Absalom seems to have fallen prey to the same ploy that Ziba used against David at the beginning of the chapter. Hushai is speaking to Absalom in a flattering tone. And that led Absalom to make a rash and unwise decision. Now, after receiving Hushai into his service, Absalom then asked Ahithophel what he would counsel him to do at this point. Now that he's arrived in Jerusalem, now that he's taken over the king's house, what should he do? What should his next step be? And the advice that comes from Ahithophel is shocking and scandalous. What he says is, Absalom, you should have sexual intercourse with the 10 concubines or second-class wives, not full wives, but second-class wives that David had left behind to care for his house. Why did Ahithophel give this counsel? Was it just out of spite and meanness? No, there was a strategy here. Ahithophel knew that this bold and contemptible act would make it clear that there was no turning back at this point. It would demonstrate that Absalom had absolutely no intention of seeking any kind of reconciliation with his father. And this would make those who had thrown in their lot with Absalom all the more committed to his cause, because it made it very clear that if Absalom goes down at this point, they will go down too, because there is not going to be any reconciliation here. So Absalom followed Ahithophel's evil counsel, and he made sure that everyone knew what he was doing, pitched this tent up on the roof. Now, of course, it was not good for David to have multiple wives and to have concubines on top of that. But at this point in the working out of the plan of redemption, God, in his wisdom, chose not to confront this particular departure from his creational pattern for marriage as a lifelong union between one man and one woman. God seems to have tolerated. God did tolerate it for a time. Although when we look at these kinds of arrangements, we can see the mess that they create. So even in that, we see that this is not in accord with God's creational pattern for marriage. So David's polygamy was sinful, absolutely. But this in no way excused what Absalom did. The scriptures make it very clear that this is a heinous sin. It is a heinous sin to have sexual relations with someone who has had sexual relations with one of your parents. This sin cost the patriarch Reuben his birthright as Jacob's firstborn son. And when a man in the church of Corinth was found guilty of this sort of sin, Paul told the church to excommunicate the man. Now, there's a sad irony here when we think about what's going on. It's sadly ironic that Absalom would follow Ahithophel's wicked counsel. After all, Absalom was driven to murder Amnon. Why? He was driven to murder Amnon because Amnon had raped Absalom's sister, Tamar. It was a sexual sin. And yet here we see Absalom falling into sexual sin. The same kind of depravity. You could say it's even worse, actually. It's tenfold. Not just one instance, but 10 instances. And this fulfills the word that the Lord spoke to David through Nathan the prophet back in chapter 12. I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. So once again, an example of the doctrine of concursus or concurrence, where Absalom is the one committing the evil, and yet God is sovereign over it. This is the fulfillment of what God had said would happen as a consequence of David's sin with Bathsheba. So Ahithophel is David's betrayer here. He betrayed David by going over to Absalom's side and giving the usurper this odious and shrewd advice. And you notice that the writer, at the very end of the chapter, he calls our attention to the fact that Ahithophel's counsel was highly esteemed by everyone, even by David. And this just calls our attention to the tall task that lay ahead of Hushai. He has been given the task by David to somehow frustrate the counsel of Ahithophel, somehow to turn his wisdom into foolishness. How in the world is Hushai going to be able to do this? Well, it won't be on account of his own shrewdness or his own insight. It will be by the hand of God. And this really reflects what David prayed back in Psalm 18. For by you I can run against a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. Well, just to wrap everything up here as we conclude, I think, you know, we can all say in one way or another, we've all had the experience of being misled by somebody, of being falsely accused, maybe even cursed by somebody, and being betrayed by somebody. And it is certainly not pleasant when any of those things happen to us. It's very painful. And yet we can take comfort in the fact that we belong to one who has been subjected to the same kind of mistreatment. And unlike us, he bore those afflictions as one who had never committed any sin or any wrongdoing of any kind. Peter tells us in his first epistle, speaking of Jesus, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. And really, we see David following that pattern here in this chapter. He is suffering and he's not threatening in return. He's entrusting himself to him who judges justly. And it's our calling to do the same thing. It's our calling to follow in our Savior's steps, trusting that our God will use our afflictions for our good, that he is in control over all of it. And I think that this just reminds us of something that we see in John Bunyan's classic book, Pilgrim's Progress, where Christian, the pilgrim in the story, he's walking along the path and he sees these lions that are chained alongside the pathway. And he knows that he has to walk on that pathway, and he sees the lions there, and he's terrified. But he is told this. He says, "Fear not the lions, for they are chained and are placed there for trial of faith, where it is, and for discovery of those that have none. Keep in the midst of the path, and no hurt shall come unto thee." And I think that that's kind of what we see in David's life here and in his experience, as we're seeing how this trial is demonstrating his faith. It's giving an opportunity for his faith to be exercised and fanned into flame. And we can trust that the Lord will do the same thing for us in the face of the trials that he ordains in our lives. Let's join together in prayer.